Nonprofit Center for Appalachia Research in Cancer Education Care. Dr. Melissa Thomas has served as principal investigator on a number of research studies aimed at reducing the burden of cancer through culturally competent health education programs. Melissa also serves as manager of health disparities research in the Office of Health Equity at the Ohio Health Research and Innovation Institute in Columbus, Ohio. As a first-generation college student, Melissa has dedicated her life to empowering communities in memory of her grandmother, Mazie Thomas Reed, who died of cancer due to limited access to education and health care.
It's amazing to see the diversity of topics in a conversation about rural women or rural health, and I'm just really honored to be here with the presenters today. Thank you, Dr. Centauri, for the introduction, and special thanks to the Women's Health Caucus for the opportunity to present this work today. A few acknowledgments I'd like to share today, the individuals on this screen. In particular, I would like to acknowledge my colleague, Haley Regal, who was completely instrumental in the day-to-day operations and evaluation of the study. Special thanks as well to the Amish and Mennonite women who, over the last 18 years, have contributed as part of our program. We're honored to be able to share and lift up their voices for their concerns and issues surrounding breast cancer and health issues in their communities. And I also like to acknowledge there's no relationships that I have to disclose. I think in first, though, we need to talk a little bit about who the Amish and Mennonite communities are, because not everyone may have that framework. And I often say if we had more time, an exercise we like to do with community groups is to say, you know, if we had an individual from another planet come in and land right here and say, can you write down, tell us about the Amish and Mennonite communities? Often people will begin to quickly start writing who they are. But if we give the same example of some person from another planet to say, well, tell me about your people, it's a little bit more difficult to write. The pens usually stop. And we say that often we have a tendency to group people in certain categories, and we share as well today the caveat that while we've had an opportunity to work with thousands of Amish and Mennonite community members across the state of Ohio, really our results today don't reflect the entire Amish and Mennonite population, and there may be those of you who have other experiences as well that might differ from ours. Now, if we look about who they are, the media certainly has an answer in the last 5 years about who the Amish and Mennonite communities are. We've seen very reputable stations, including Learning Channel, Discovery Channel, talk about the Amish in particular, you know, realms of leaving the community or experience new technology. And sadly, these shows are really depicting, I think, as a culture, who these communities are. And there's a lot of danger in, obviously, some of those perceptions as well. Not only Amish Mafia is out now, you may realize that there's actually a new show called Amish Ghost Stories that has actually been released. So we can't trust the media, and we look to the literature, and granted, I'll provide the caveat that some of this literature is dated. But in the peer-reviewed literature, we see a lot of mixed concepts as well about the Amish and their attitude towards health behavior, health practices. We see that, again, with respect to preventive care, the Amish don't even accept the philosophy of preventive medicine. We see in another article that they don't practice medicine due to their religio-cultural beliefs. It's just a concept of health. It's just something really beyond their realm of knowledge. On contrast, though, we see in other publications that the Amish are actively involved in health promotion and that they're very eager to be engaged in not only the clinical but also alternative medicines as well. And I would like to just say that in terms of the definition we'd like to share about who the Amish and Mennonite communities are, we really like this, probably definition is best, and this really comes from our community members, but there's a great little book you can buy in any Amish store, Amish restaurant, in some of the larger areas by a husband and wife team, Murrow and Phyllis Good. And I think this is the best way to describe any population group in responding by saying that anyone who tries to answer this question in one simple sentence is either naive or purposefully unkind. Which of us would want our lives summed up in one sweeping statement? Yet many of us demand this of other people's lives. And so we just want to acknowledge the great diversity in Amish and Mennonite communities around the world, and especially even within our own state. That being said, just a little bit of background about the communities themselves. It's interesting to note that really now over half the states in the United States have Amish communities. And so we see thousands of more Mennonite communities as well across the state. But Ohio does have the world's largest and fourth largest Amish settlements. And the largest settlement consists of over 30,000 Amish community members. Now, there are some unique barriers with respect to Amish and Mennonite communities that are worthy of mentioning as well. What some may not know is that many Amish communities are trilingual, and English is their second language. The first language often spoken is a dialect of German called, we call, Pennsylvania Dutch. And this language, this Pennsylvania Dutch, is only an oral language. It cannot be written. And it's a dead language, so no new words can be added. So it makes it a unique challenge in trying to communicate with this group, because I can't even write them in their own language. And then some communities as well do speak a more formal higher German in their church services. In addition to that as well, many communities, obviously because of their religious beliefs and nonconformity with the outside world, do not have access to phones, of course, to internet, and sometimes electricity. And so to be able to even contact healthcare providers may require walking a great distance to get to a phone or waiting until one gets into town. The other issue to mention is that of transportation, because some Amish communities and Mennonite communities rely exclusively on horse and buggy for transportation services. So it makes it a little bit more challenging in terms of accessing some of the healthcare needs that are done. I mean, obviously, many appointments are really dictated upon how many miles that is away and how long it takes for horse and buggy to get there. Another comment, though, and really the impetus for the continuation of this research 18 years later, is that I conducted an epidemiological study about 10 years ago that for the first time estimated breast cancer incidence and mortality rates among Amish women in the world's largest and fourth largest settlements. And what's interesting to note is that we case matched over 19,000 records in collaboration with the Ohio Department of Health. And what we were able to realize is that while the incidence rates of breast cancer were about half that of the state and national numbers with respect to looking at just a comparison of white women, which we attributed in part to lower screening rates, we did notice a significantly higher death rate of breast cancer for Amish women, specifically in the world's largest Amish settlement. And just a couple numbers here. If we're looking at the time period from 1996 to 2002, the mortality rates for breast cancer overall in the state of Ohio for white women was 28.9 per 100,000. SEER national data for white women was 25.9 per 100,000. And in the world's largest settlement, the mortality rate from breast cancer was 43.9 per 100,000. The leading cause of death of Amish women under the age of 60 was breast cancer. Now, I know we sometimes attribute that, well, they're not getting screened, so they're being diagnosed late stage, and that's not the case. We found many cases of breast cancer diagnosed at local stages and women dead within 5 years. Now, we can certainly talk about some hypotheses on why that is, and clearly some of that has to deal with access. We did note anecdotally experiences of discrimination and prejudice within the healthcare system and lack of opportunities for being able to access full options with treatment and delivery of breast cancer services. Quickly, just a little information about our program itself. The name of our program specifically is called Project Hoffnung, and I'll describe that, but Hoffnung is the German word for hope. And this is a multi-agency collaboration between Ohio Health, which is one of the largest healthcare providers in the state of Ohio, serving over half the county's staff of 28,000. And then in addition to that, our Project Hoffnung program was established in 1997 as a result of work I was doing with the National Cancer Institute that was addressing the disproportionately higher cancer rates in the Appalachian region of the United States. I noticed that we were doing a lot of mobile screenings in more rural areas, and there was an Amish community not coming out to a site, and I just wanted to know why. So we were able to establish a program, really, that to make the distinction too, that Project Hoffnung is a community-led initiative, and we distinguish that between community-based participatory research projects, where clearly the community itself is leading and directing the work that we're doing. And so we're here really as a resource to empower communities, provide them knowledge and resources, but we let them drive the ship in terms of the direction that we take with our program. So Project Hoffnung really relied on fiscal agents and other community groups to be able to establish that framework for grant funding and donations to do the program. And happy to report that in 2011, a new nonprofit organization was established called the Center for Appalachia Research and Cancer Education that had a mission of reducing the burden of cancer in Appalachian rural communities by, number one, providing culturally competent healthcare and health education, by educating healthcare professionals about the distinct cultural and healthcare needs of communities, and researching, planning, implementing, and evaluating effective health interventions to achieve health equity in cancer education, screening, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. Now, our logo, for we needed to brand our project. We initially were called the Amish and Mennonite Breast Cancer Project, and many community members wondered why we were just singling out them. Why aren't you helping everybody, not just us? And so we decided to go through a branding process and establish an identity within the community. And so Project Hoffnung adapted a logo that, of course, we know the pink ribbon stands for breast cancer, And I know, seriously, we never even thought about this until later, and the distinction between the rainbow and the use in identifying with LGBT communities. But the rainbow in our logo was established really more from a biblical perspective, and that of use of a promise. And just as God had promised that he wouldn't ever destroy the earth again with a flood, we used the pink ribbon over the rainbow as a symbol of promise and hope in the fight against breast cancer for Amish and Mennonite women. Now, since the establishment of our program in 1997, we've gone through 8 distinct iterations of our breast cancer intervention. And initially, our education program was established in really utilizing a program from the American Cancer Society called Triple Touch. We called it an Ohio Special Touch. And we loved it because it had a flip chart format. It was definitely something we could utilize, didn't require any other technological resources. And so there were specific factors that were identified in this program. And note too, at the time, there was no research that established anything regarding knowledge, attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors surrounding breast cancer with these population groups. One of the lessons that we learned was that there was a big section of the education program that talked about risk factors. And so we would have community members coming in very concerned and talking about risk factors, and women would leave saying, this is great, I'm not going to get breast cancer. I don't smoke. I breastfeed all my children. I've had many children before the age of 30, so thank you, I don't have to worry about this. So we knew we needed to go back to the drawing board and establish definitely a much more tailored intervention for these community groups. So obviously our previous research looked at specific focus groups and came from interviews and lots of data collection to establish our program. The program specifically we're talking about today was data that we collected in 2013-14, but really it was establishing a program that was looking at specifically how we can deliver culturally competent education to these communities. And really the premise of our education is this, and I think this really identifies with all of the groups that we presented today, is that we know we have information that can save women's lives, and if you only have 15 minutes to spend with a woman you may never see again, what are the key messages that you should be sharing with her that may have an impact? And that really our program was adapted from Dr. Victoria Champion's health belief model, and we were looking at perceived benefits and barriers associated with breast cancer screening. If we can increase compliance to recommended breast cancer screening guidelines, we can hopefully get into obviously diagnosing breast cancer in early stage and make an impact on reducing the burden of cancer. The specific program that we asked is that what we identified in a previous study in 2011 and 12 is that, yes, we were excited to see that we were able to statistically and significantly increase breast cancer knowledge among these population groups within our grant periods, but we noticed that there was, overall we made an impact, but we noticed that for women who were past participants, who were repeat participants in the program, there was not an increase in knowledge. There was this flatline effect with our education program that we delivered. So we talked to our community members who felt like there was really just this super saturation of knowledge. The way that our interventions developed is that we have mobile screenings with healthcare providers on site in some of the most resource-starved areas of the state. And so women are required to participate in an education intervention before going into any screenings. And previous participants just checked out. They'd already received the education. So we adapted our program to say, is it possible that we can focus on key messages for previous participants in the study that actually would only focus on a 4-minute education program? Could we just identify those key breast cancer facts with participants who had already participated? And the way that our program was established was that anybody who had been within our program for the last 2 years was identified as what we called an old participant. Not the best terminology, but they were the old ones. And then we had our new participants who had been there for obviously the very first time. Any new participant received the full 15-minute education program that was adapted from obviously our research over the number of years. For any old participant, they received a 4-minute education program that highlighted those key messages. Now, specifically then for that, between that grant period, we actually were able to educate 541 women. I would like to give just a quick little shout out to my mother, Doretta, who's a co-author, who actually is the key educator for our program. She's actually one of our Amish screenings today in the world's largest settlement, but it's a key factor in doing all of the education almost that we have with the program. So we had a nice divide between the two education groups. And I know that obviously you can't read this data, but we wanted to share at least this so that you can access it later online. We were looking at these specific breast cancer messages, and this table identifies both pre- and post-test responses for both old and new participants on the key questions that we're asking here today. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
five, six,
yes, nine questions in this particular intervention that we were looking at. And again, adapted from Dr. Victoria Champion's health belief model. What we noticed from our results was that specifically between pre and post, and surveys were disseminated 3 months after the intervention, just to give you that framework to understand. And one of the things that we always like to see with our data and looking at our negative differences and positive differences and ties is that if you notice, there are nine key questions are addressed here, and I can answer any more questions you have later about this, but we're looking at obviously that three layers of data, but the back row is identifying those individuals who really got the answers right. They had no change in their response from pre to post test. Now the group that we like to see in the middle, those are the individuals who had the wrong answer for the pre-test on each question, but then answered correctly in the post-test. So we like to see that shift and the individuals are getting those answers correct. Probably more interesting to us is that first row, and those are individuals who got the answer right in pre, but then answered incorrectly post. And that's been something that really was of interest to us, is what's making that happen there. Now some of that can be attributed to just guessing by just making a response by chance, but we did notice some key factors. And specifically, one of the questions that we ask on, and who, actually, if you're looking at the second from the left, we have a question about who cancer. And this question is associated with breast cancer risk. So the question asks, who is more likely to get breast cancer, women older than 50, women younger than 50, or there's no difference? And we noticed that especially with old participants, it seemed that question seemed to be answered more incorrectly the second time. We know that age is a risk factor associated with breast cancer, but please note too, the interesting facts we're sharing with communities is that the leading cause of death in women under the age of 60 is breast cancer in this community. And so even some of the messaging we felt we had was a little conflicting in how we communicated that risk to this community group. In addition to that, the bonus was that obviously we did see a statistically significant increase in knowledge for both old and new participants with the delivery of a 4-minute education intervention. In addition to that, one of the interesting things we noticed is that overall, looking at total post-test knowledge score, it did seem again that for the old participants, there was more of a shift in actually answering questions incorrectly at that post-test than there were with the new group. And that was something that we want to continue to identify. The other piece that we wanted to mention to you as well is that it was not as strong as we expected. In other studies, we did see a significant relationship between age and knowledge at both pre- and post-test levels. There was a weak relationship, but really there were clearly other factors here to consider with this study. The other piece to say is that obviously one of the points that we acknowledged is that we felt like with this population group for the old participants that we almost had met a threshold of how much knowledge that one could attain. The biggest question that seems to be of concern to this community is truly, again, understanding risk. And we can attribute that in some cases to health literacy and numeracy issues, because as you know, the key messaging we share with community groups is that your risk of breast cancer over a lifetime is 1 in 8. And this was still very much a confusing concept, even when we translated that to say the risk of getting breast cancer over a woman's lifetime is high. So we acknowledge that even though if you look at our pre- and post-test scores for individuals who had previously participated, we really couldn't move beyond that threshold to reach that total score of correct 9 in that population group. And again, I mentioned that comment about our health numeracy issues. A few other comments about the limitations for this study. The great thing is about our population is that we had about a 50% response rate for our post-test data, which is really incredible, but we acknowledge there might be some limitations in those who did not choose to participate in the post-test. The other comment too to make, and we shared in a previous presentation, was that we in other studies had looked at stages of change to see if we can acknowledge compliance to breast cancer screening guidelines. But for us, the note to make here is that all of the education interventions are taking place at a screening site. So women are already engaged and interested in receiving breast cancer screening who are participating in this particular study. Previously, we had done education sessions in communities, but it really was that it was preferred really to say, well, it takes so much time to get to a screening. We would rather do everything together one day. Let's educate. Let's do the screening. Let's make sure that we're all there together at the same time. The other point to make as well is that all of our programs are implemented by Amish and Mennonite community health workers. I often say that you don't have to belong to a community to help, but you do have to know your place. And we clearly acknowledge the incredible work of Amish and Mennonite community members who serve as really the leaders on this program in the study. I'll note, though, another piece to point out is that the key education that's delivered typically we would see a train-the-trainer model that would be effective. We would train Amish and Mennonite community health workers to deliver our education piece. Our experience has been is that the Amish and Mennonite women did not want to educate. It was really an uncomfortable position to put women from the community in a position to be a teacher, because in some cases women felt like they were higher than their community members, that they knew more. They preferred to have a quote English or non-Amish person deliver our education, which is why my mother is one of our key educators. The other just last comment was that we clearly acknowledge this is a challenging group to understand some of the other confounding variables, because it is such a homogenous group. Almost everybody's white, everybody's married almost. Everybody has about the same level of education. So it makes it a little more challenging to try and identify other demographic variables that might impact the differences we see in attaining those knowledge scores. Again, thank you very much, and acknowledge again my relationship with Walden University as faculty and again with the Ohio Health Research Institute. Thanks again. Right, and that's a great question, looking at trying to address some of those factors associated with access or treatment, and was that part of the education or the intervention? And it absolutely was. Part one of the study was being able to provide that access. So we really identified those key areas where there were the least amount of resources available to access breast cancer education or screening and treatment. And so we also developed a very rigorous continuum of care model. So with any, because obviously we're statewide, and if we're out in a community that's very remote and we take the van out, we take healthcare providers out, and then we leave and someone has a follow-up that's needed, how do we do that? And it is a very rigorous process that we include our nurse practitioner, the community health worker, in trying to identify the best way in terms of even contacting community members about that need. And the other piece too that we really try to focus on, in addition to educating community members, is that of educating healthcare providers. So we establish specific culturally competent health education sessions with healthcare providers in those areas that are actually facilitated by Amish and Mennonite community health workers. And what we've noticed is that people have a lot of myths. This is a group that people find very curious because of the way they dress and their obviously lack of technology. So in some ways, breaking down those barriers and let people just ask any question that they want. We also this year had an inaugural Amish healthcare conference that allowed, again, leaders in the community to talk about best practices in delivering care. And I know that that's made a big impact in trying to reduce those barriers. We feel often that, I think in many communities here, people try to be so overly politically correct that they say, oh, well, we feel that sometimes treatment options aren't being offered to Amish community members because they feel, oh, well, they wouldn't do that. They don't believe in the technology, or they don't believe in birth control, or they don't believe in it. And so assumptions are made about treatment. And so we're really trying to break down those barriers on the healthcare provider side. Thank you.
Other questions? Extent, though, would any of you look Yes, and I think the quote was from the Illinois study. And we didn't we asked a lot of demographic questions, but more in relation to their previous experiences with weight loss and then their ability to maintain it. Not and I agree with you about their knowledge base, and that would be a great thing to include in the future too, is where are they kind of at with that. I think one of the things we thought about when we developed the study was that they had been successful at losing weight, so they did understand, and there were very few. I think there might have been one that had a lap band procedure, but otherwise it was diet and exercise. But like you said, equating that knowledge then to us changing the behavior. And I agree about the emotional eating. I think we were most interested in all the barriers we have for physical activity and how could we sort out how to make it more amenable for participants to actually participate in the physical activity over time. Does that answer your question well enough?
I didn't talk about the intervention that we're doing right now, but we are trying to change behaviors related to eating and physical activity, but just because of it's community-based and the burden of multiple surveys, we're just looking at behavior and not and clinical measures and not looking at knowledge, so I can't really answer the question.
Other questions from the audience?
I just had a question for the last presenter. I wasn't sure if I heard you correctly in terms of the community health workers. Did you say that some of the community health workers are from the community, or that some in the community opted out to be community health workers for different reasons? I wasn't clear.
Yeah, that's a great question, looking at the role of the community health workers and how they were identified. Yeah, and I should make the distinction that it was really more about the role of the community health workers. So we specifically have Amish and Mennonite community health workers who are in the community but chose not to serve as like the teacher or the educator. And so the delivery of the education was preferred to be given by someone who was not part of the community. And so the roles themselves were specifically defined. So obviously all of the outreach that's done, a lot of our work is done door to door, you know, identifying communities. So all of that is actually taking place by our community health workers. So we provide that training and model. Ohio is one of the few states that has a certification process for community health workers. And so we're excited that our first certified community health worker from the Mennonite community is actually just going through courses right now, and so we're really excited that that's going to offer that extra level of knowledge. So we do a lot of in-services because they're really the voices and faces of the community. So if we have issues with questions or knowledge or issues with access, you know, we've often found, I think with many rural communities this was identified, the women were so grateful for the chance of us to be able to out there and help them that they often wouldn't tell us what was going wrong or there was a problem. So they would look right at me and say, everything was great today, thank you, but then turn around and walk out with one of our community workers and say, I didn't like what happened or I was uncomfortable. So yes, it was really more the role as opposed to the identification of the community members. Yeah, that's a great question, and I know we didn't have in the sense of time, but I think for us, we try to make the distinction between community-led. We hear a lot about community-based participatory research, don't we? And we see a lot, you know, we see a lot of especially academic institutions who get grant funding, go out and do focus groups or community groups, and the study's established, and then they go back and share the data with the community, but it's not necessarily something the community is leading or driving. And so we've taken a step back to say, let's learn more through focus groups. We're using research as a tool to give that research back to communities to say, what do you want to do? And it's a very empowering thing to be able to have this, because when we have questions about how to lead the project or someone, collaborations, for example, another organization wants to collaborate with us or wants to do a study, this is all determined by the community members themselves who are part of an advisory board. You know, it's important to note, too, that for Amish communities, for the world's largest settlement, there is no overarching governing council, for example, as opposed to other church-based groups. So in order for us to work in the world's largest settlement, we needed permission from over 250 individual bishops of individual churches in that area. So for us, we really try to focus on making sure that the community is driving what we're doing. All movement is handled by their permission and their guidance. Thank you.
All right, I think we're just about at time, so let's say one more thank you to an excellent group of presenters.